The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Everybody must understand that from the foundation of our country, infrastructure has been the primary driver of growth and economic success.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was Barry LePatner, who you just heard there. And we're going to be talking a little bit about our nation's infrastructure coming up. Something you may want to know if you cross a bridge every day or drive through a tunnel. We've talked about our power grid and a lot of other stuff. How vulnerable are we as a nation? You probably heard that story about the Mississippi being shut down. And this was not hacking. It's faulty infrastructure. I'll fill you in. This is something I've been reporting on for years. And I've been looking at our nation's infrastructure. Of course, we know the battle that's going on in Capitol Hill right now. You know, between, spending trillions of dollars for infrastructure. I said, and I don't want to get into it now, but it is a bipartisan issue. I think people on both sides of the aisle believe we need to make sure our bridges are safe and our roads are solid, right? And our tunnels are safe, right? But and this is the culture we live in. There's an attempt to redefine what the word infrastructure means. Isn't that bizarre? Well, you know it is, right? What do you mean? Infrastructure, it means your roads, your bridges, your tunnels, your dams, right? No. According to some Democrats there, they want to redefine it as a much broader sense. And we'll look at it. Maybe they're right. We'll take a look at what they are proposing and how your money's going to be spent. But I think it's the most important thing to look at right now is your safety. So coming up in a few minutes, a little later in the hour, I'll get into that. It's a conversation you're going to hear, that's for sure. If you live in Ohio, I want to talk to you especially. I wish a lot of states were doing this. Check this out, right? If you're in Ohio, you have not been vaccinated against COVID-19 yet. The state government, they really want you to do it, right? In fact, they want you to do it so much, they want to incentivize you. And maybe your state is incentivizing you, giving you discounts or tickets to ball games or, you know, things along those lines. I like this incentive. Check this out, right? If you are not yet vaccinated and you're willing to get vaccinated, they're going to enter your name in a lottery to win $1 million. $1 million. The money comes from the federal COVID relief funds, but the drawing is going to be conducted by the Ohio Lottery. Take a listen to Governor DeWine of Ohio and what was said about this special lottery.
On Wednesday, May 26, we will announce the winner of a drawing of all those 17-year-olds and under who have been vaccinated, and the winner will receive a full four-year scholarship to any one of our state universities. This will include tuition, room and board, and books. 2 weeks from tonight, on May 26th, we will announce a winner of a separate drawing for adults who have received at least their first dose of the vaccine. This announcement will occur each Wednesday for 5 weeks, and the winner each Wednesday will receive $1 million.
Wow. Well, who doesn't want to win? Who doesn't want to get, who doesn't want $1 million, right? Pandemic, it turned out to be a blessing to that particular person. I know many of you may be vaccinated. A lot of you are saying, look, Drew, I'm just not going to do it. I'm not sure about this. I'm concerned about the ethics. I'm concerned about that. If you're in Ohio, starting the 26th, mark your calendars for the following four Wednesdays. One person's name is going to be drawn. Also, the name of one teenager under the age 18 will be drawn to win a full ride to any of the Buckeye State's public colleges or university. That's a big blessing too, right? The hope, of course, is that more people will get the jab. And by the way, the program, you know, they came up with a name for it. It's called Vax-a-Million. I don't know whether that's good or bad. Vax-a-Million? Oh, boy. The pandemic in India, on a more serious note, is getting worse. I'll call you to pray about that. Look, COVID is real. And I don't want to downplay it at all. I mean, this is real. You may have lost a loved one. I lost people that I know. I mean, Father Ubald was a great friend of mine. He was called home. Father Seraphim Michalenko, another great priest, great proponent of divine mercy, died from a complication from COVID-19. The pandemic in India is out of control. Bodies have been found floating in the river there. There are people who are presumed to have died from COVID-19. States have been unwilling to share their supplies of oxygen with each other because that's how many people are sick in their hospitals. ABC News will report for you on how bad this pandemic actually is.
India is at a breaking point. COVID cases there are soaring. The country's medical system is nearing collapse. Now anti-government anger is growing and officials are preparing for things to get worse.
The country's healthcare system pushed to its breaking point. This doctor telling me they don't have the nurses, doctors, or supplies to treat all of those sick with COVID. In just the past 24 hours, more than 400,000 new COVID cases and more than 4,000 deaths. And experts believe those numbers are drastically underreported, with one estimate predicting that 1 million Indians could die from COVID-19 by August. International aid is pouring in, as many tell us. They feel the country's healthcare system has failed them, and now they have to step in to help themselves. Outside this hospital, we meet people making desperate calls to find help for their loved ones. This couple is told there's no room for their aunt. This man tells us he's tried more than 20 hospitals and clinics. So far, no one has an ICU bed for his uncle. He says while the government claims there's enough oxygen and medical care for everyone, the reality on the ground is desperate.
All right, so keep them in your prayers. I can't imagine not having the oxygen you need in those final hours, you know, as you're trying to just to breathe, because this is a... You know, COVID has affected a lot of lungs, you know, a lot of respiratory systems. Now the World Health Organization is saying that the strain is causing, this particular Indian strain, it's causing most of the sickness that's present in 44 countries around the world. So pray for the people of India. I'm not quite sure, to be honest with you, how well the vaccine that you have is against this particular vaccination. I don't know if they know that. You know, I was just a side thought here. I'm thinking, I know that they're talking about boosters and there's all these different variants that are out there. You know, you've got the South American, the African. We have our own variant here in the States. So I'll pray for your safety. You know, you pray for mine as well. In fact, I saw one other story here. This is something that I didn't get a chance to dive into. I saw it as I was sitting down in my chair here before the broadcast. The CDC says that fully vaccinated people don't have to wear masks indoors. That's pretty good. If you're in the office, you're in church, right? You're in the grocery store, you're at the restaurant. I saw that headline. It was reported in Axios. They said that the CDC was announcing new guidance that anyone who's been fully vaccinated can participate indoor and outdoor activities without wearing a mask or physically distancing regardless of the crowd size. So, you know, will that drive up people saying, all right, I'm going to get the vaccine, I can lose the mask? What they're saying is that if you're fully vaccinated, you are protected, and then you can start going and doing things that you stopped doing because of the pandemic. There was a White House press briefing, and the director there, the CDC director, Rochelle Walensky, made that comment. There are some caveats. The guidance does not apply to those traveling on planes or in public transit. Or in healthcare settings, or correctional facilities, or homeless shelters. So masks have to be worn, and you have to abide by whatever the federal, state, or local, or territorial guidance is. So we'll see. It's going to take a little while before the masks are totally history, but we'll see. But vaccinated people traveling from other countries to the U.S., you still need negative COVID tests prior to your to their trip to prove, you know, make sure you have proof of a previous COVID infection in the past 3 months. So. A lot going on here. We'll see. Just between the lines, news reports this past week have pointed to the public health experts' critiques of the agency's overly cautious guidance. Some say they have not accounted for the scientific findings that could change public attitudes and behaviors, but we'll see what happens. That's a little news for you. Keep it in your, you know, keep it on your radar there. We'll see what happens with churches in our own country. I'd like to see what happens there. You go to a restaurant anyway. You go to sit down. The second you get there, you're standing waiting to be seated. You get your mask on. You sit down. You take it off. You're not that far away from your waiter or from, you know, from, you know, the table next to you. It's kind of silly. One final story here. This deals with Bill and Melinda Gates. I don't know if you heard about this at all. You probably have. Bill and Melinda are divorcing. You know, Bill apparently told his golf buddies that his marriage had been loveless for some times, whatever that means. And it also come out that Melinda gave him permission to spend one weekend a year with an old flame. California or North Carolina. I actually saw the place. They did a piece on this a couple days ago. I'm thinking, if I was Bill Gates, I would not be staying in this place. You know, for a couple hundred bucks, you can run it, right? I mean, but he and his ex-girlfriend, you're married. Yeah, I'm going to go spend a weekend with my ex. That'd be fun, right? Why not? We'll ride, do buggies, we'll hang out, we'll have dinner together. Well, who knows what they're going to be doing, right? GMA, ABC News and GMA, they speculated on the reason for the divorce. Is it because the marriage grew tepid? Is it because they're loveless? Is it because they have an open relationship? Melinda's cool with this. Or is there something more? Some believe it has to do with Jeffrey Epstein, of all people. Listen to this.
New details about what may have led to Bill and Melinda Gates' multi-billion dollar divorce.
These are two billionaires that were working with extensive legal teams over many months since at least 2019.
According to the Wall Street Journal, the split has been nearly 2 years in the making. Sources telling the Journal, Melinda first turned to divorce attorneys as her husband's connection to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein became public. Emily Glazer, who broke the story, speaking out to GMA overnight.
Melinda Gates's divorce lawyers were having multiple calls right around the time that the New York Times published an October 2019 article detailing the extent of Bill Gates's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. We do know that this is a source of concern.
Well, we'll see what the truth is, I guess. I don't know if you even care, to be honest with you. But what I do know is that she's getting, she's a Catholic. And we should care. We should care about her. We should care about Bill. We should care about marriage. What you may not have heard is that she is reportedly seeking an annulment from the Holy See. She's going to the Vatican. Wants her marriage annulled. I have a friend who works on a tribunal. And we were talking about this. And he says, you know what? It won't be a hard divorce to get. There's a lot of things that are being reported that, if true, she'll be able to be divorced. The Daily Mail reported that she struggled with getting divorced because of what they termed, this was the Daily Mail, her, quote, strict Roman Catholic faith. Okay. I hope she's a strict Roman Catholic. That's fantastic. I don't believe it. You know, she favors abortion. She's open to contraception and sterilization. How do you say that she's got a strict outlook on her Catholic faith? And I don't believe it. I don't like when Catholics are misrepresented. I think it hurts the faith overall. I don't believe that at all. You can call yourself Catholic. You are not a Catholic if you're not in communion with what the church teaches. If you dissent from it, you know, then I think you need to dial back on that, especially if you are a proponent of abortion, contraception, sterilization. It's like spitting in the face of God, you know. But she was brought up Catholic, and she understands the sanctity of marriage, supposedly. And she won't have to go to the Vatican, though, to seek the declaration of nullity. She'll have to deal with a local chancery in the Archdiocese of Seattle first. That's how it begins. So, and it'll only be if Bill contests it, and if he wins, if Melinda appeals, or if Melinda wins and Bill appeals, whatever the case is to be heard, Rome, most likely, if they hear it, it'll be at the Rota. But I don't think it's going to go that far, to be honest with you. So we will see. We'll see what ultimately happens. On another note, outside of our borders, there is that conflict in Israel that we really need to be concerned about and continue to pray for. I've got great reservations about what's now unfolding there. And, you know, tensions are running high. Tempers are hot. Life is being lost. And things like this can escalate. The conflict in Israel is just not slowing down. I reported on this yesterday to you. According to news reports, 1,500 rockets, they've rained down from Israel all the way to Gaza over the last few days. Most of them have been targeted on the southern part of the country, but some of them have landed in Jerusalem and in Tel Aviv. In fact, officials have closed the country's main airport, and they are diverting traffic now to other airports in the country. In addition to this, cities all across the area, like Haifa and Tel Aviv, they have that mixed Arab and Israeli populations. They're seeing violence in their streets, riots, there's looting, there's burning. You know, it's horrible what we're seeing right now in the street. And Israel's Iron Dome system, you know, that's when a rocket comes in, the Iron Dome fires off other rockets that shoot those out of the sky. They shot down a lot of rockets, but those things are not bulletproof, right? Some rockets have gotten through. Their Air Force is now targeting numerous places in the Gaza Strip, and there is serious, serious talk about a land invasion to try to take out rocket installations that Hamas has set up right now. At least 70 people have been killed because of the conflict, and thousands have been injured. So the dispute has come as a result of these pending evictions. I don't know if you followed any of this story. I know sometimes the Middle East and things outside your borders are, you know, off your radar. This whole dispute arose because of the pending evictions of some Palestinians from one part of Jerusalem. There's supposed to be a court hearing about that on Monday, but that got canceled because of the violence. But the issue isn't as clear-cut as many in the media have been making it seem. And I want to go to Israel now. I want to welcome to the program David Rubin. He's a native New Yorker and a the former mayor of Shiloh, Israel. He's the author of a new book called Confronting Radicals, What Americans Can Learn from Israel. And he joins us live tonight. It's good to have you with us. Good evening, David. Appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Drew. Good to be with you.
Let me first express my condolences. I hate to see this violence and the conflict that is now taking place. My prayers are with you, and I'm praying for peace, of course. But, you know, a lot of Americans, they'll get a blip, as you know, in our U.S. news. And so often things outside our borders aren't often reported in depth. There's been a lot of coverage of this, though, I have to say that. But fill everyone in on what's happening. Let's start with the evictions. The mainstream media here are making it sound like the Palestinians are being evicted just to make room for Jewish settlers. But really, it's a lot more complicated than that. Can you maybe paint a picture or briefly give us some of the real background?
Yeah, well, look, I could give you the facts about what you're calling evictions, but that's not the issue. That's not what's going on here in Israel. I mean, we've had all of these rockets that have been fired at Israel. It's just in the past week, and in the build up to Jerusalem Day. There are Jews who've been killed in the streets, who've been wounded in the streets, fire bombs on synagogues, hundreds of cars, Jewish-owned cars, torched by Palestinian rioters, and not just the ones who call themselves, you know, they also Arab Israelis today call themselves Palestinians. You know, it's a people that they created for the Arabs of the land of Israel. But it's a wild scene, and it is a war against Israel. It is a terror war against Israel, literally.
What sparked it, though? What was the genesis of this?
Well, look, this has been going on for about 30 years. There's no spark, except for one political spark, which is a big one. President Trump had cut off all aid to the Palestinian Authority because it was funding terrorism for the past 20 years, specifically giving salaries to every terrorist who kills or wounds a Jew. And in fact, I was wounded along with my three-year-old son in a terror attack about 20 years ago, right when they were starting this. And my son was shot in the head. Now, those terrorists that wounded the two of us, thank God we survived, but that wounded the two of us have been receiving salaries every single month from that Palestinian Authority. And the Palestinian Authority had their aid cut off by President Trump for that reason. Now, President Biden came in, and despite the fact that they have not stopped giving those monthly salaries to terrorists, President Biden restored $300 million in funding to the Palestinian Authority unconditionally. Now, if that's not a green light, or as you call it, a spark for the renewed aggression and terrorism from the Palestinians, I don't know what is.
Wow. Unbelievable. So, in terms of what happens next, talk about the invasion, the land invasion of the Gaza Strip. That happened once before. Would an invasion, you think, successfully eliminate the threat of rockets landing in Israel? And what happens after that?
Okay, well, you're talking about a ground offensive, and as opposed to an air offensive, which is what we've been doing for the past 2 days. Okay, the air offense has only been for the past 2 days. The rioting was going on, the rockets were flying, and then Israel started responding. I just want to be very, very clear about that. And, you know, I applaud those 44 Republican senators who came out with a resolution basically praising Israel for defending itself and calling on the Biden administration to come out very strongly in defense of Israel. So I'm happy to see that there are some people out there who recognize the truth. But where is it going to go from here? Well, Israel needs to continue its offensive, and yes, you can't win a war with just an air offensive. It doesn't work.
Right.
They have missile launchers there. They have bomb factories, many of which are being hidden in United Nations relief organization hospitals and schools. They hide them there because they want Israel to attack there, to attack their weapons, and then civilians get hurt. So it's a very cynical game that they play, and Israel has to get the ground forces in there to really find out what's happening and to do the job and clean up the hornet's nest, so to speak.
Yeah. I'm speaking today to David Rubin. He's joining us live from Israel, and he's the author of a book called Confronting Radicals, What American Can Learn from Israel. And when we come back, and David, I hope I have you for a few more moments, I do want to find out, speaking of Donald Trump, what these other nations are doing. What are the other Arab countries doing? You know, what are the countries that signed the peace deals with Israel under the Trump administration saying and doing about all this? We'll continue our conversation. I'll tell you what, I only have them for a few moments. So if you want to get in, you've got a question or a comment, feel free to dial in now at 888-914-9149. If you need clarity, you want to sound off, maybe you have a perspective you want to share, 888-914-9149. We'll continue our conversation. Our gratitude to David Rubin, live in Israel. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Yeah, the militant group Hamas has now fired more than 1,000 rockets towards Israel, and the Israeli army continues to respond with full force. It has launched a series of airstrikes over the last couple of days, continuing to pound that Palestinian territory.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, the conflict continues. People losing their lives, rockets continuing to fly on both sides. I'm joined today by David Rubin. He's a native New Yorker, former mayor of the city of Shiloh, Israel. He authored a new book called Confronting Radicals, What America Can Learn from Israel. And he is live tonight in Israel with a look from the ground, trying to give us some history and perspective on what is now unfolding. And David, again, this is a very troubling situation, to say the least. I was curious when we left off, we were talking a little bit about the Trump administration and the fact he cut off funding to Palestine. The Biden administration came back $300 million to them. What's happening with these other Arab countries, as I said? We had this historic peace deal with Israel under the Trump administration. What are those countries saying, and is there... are they going to come to the aid of Israel at all?
Okay, well, let me first point out that there is no country called Palestine. And I think that's, I'm not being petty here, I'm just making an important point, because when you invade a country, there are certain ramifications for that. And we're not talking about a country. There is no country called Palestine. There never was a country called Palestine in history. And I defy anyone, I challenge anyone who thinks that there was a country called Palestine in history, to tell me what the flag of that country was, what the national anthem of that country was, in what year that country was established, and in what year that country lost its independence. They can't tell us that. They can't answer those questions. They can't even tell us what the currency of that country was, because it didn't have a currency. There was no country like that. Okay, now that I pointed that out, obviously there is a people in Israel, Arabs who live in Israel, who have adopted the name Palestinians in the past 50 years. And so we'll let them adopt that name. But I think we need to be accurate about that there is no country called Palestine. Okay, so in answer to your question about the Arab nations that made peace with Israel during the Trump administration, there were four of them, and it was very significant. And what was interesting to me is that those countries, when President Trump made peace with, between those countries and Israel, and Trump deserves all the credit for it, along with Mike Pompeo and, Jared Kushner, others who worked with him. When he made that peace, everyone was saying that there's going to be war, that the, Palestinians are going to threaten, and also when he moved the embassy to Jerusalem, the same threats. When he recognized the Golan Heights, the strategic Golan Heights, as a part of Israel, all of the threats sort of disappeared. Why? Because when you act resolutely and you act on the side of historical truth, then people aren't going to challenge you. And when you act strongly, when a nation like the United States, which is a strong nation, acts resolutely, it gains respect. It might not gain the love of the Palestinian terrorists. Hamas may not have a celebration of President Trump, but they respect it. Yeah. Now, unfortunately, there has always been this threat. That's why the Arab countries haven't made peace with Israel until recently, because there was always this threat from the Palestinians that they're going to activate their terrorist organizations against any country that makes peace with Israel. President Trump made it possible for them to go ahead and make peace with Israel because he neutralized the Palestinian threats. And what we're seeing now with the Biden administration sort of taking this very weak approach towards the Palestinians, and actually giving them $300 million in the bargain, and acting in an obsequious way towards Iran, towards the radical regime in radical Islamic regime in Iran. In the Middle East, we're in a pretty tough neighborhood, and they recognize weakness. And so the Palestinians and Iran, they recognize weakness in this case. And they're making their threats again to those Arab nations as well. And so those four Arab nations that made peace with Israel are taking a very low profile right now because they see that the tide is on the side of the Palestinian radicals.
All right. Well, let's take a call or two for you, too. If you want to join us, 888-914-9149. Before I take a call, though, just speaking of Hamas, I want to get back to that. Their leadership has called on... And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but Hamas, their leaders called, for the beheading of Jews. This was on Twitter. And yet I was struck because Twitter has done nothing about that. Does Israel, does Israel have what it takes to take out Hamas? Will Iran come to the rescue of Hamas again? I mean, how do you see that playing out?
Iran would not dare to attack Israel, because they know they know what would happen to them if they did. Look, the Hamas is a terrorist, extreme Islamic terrorist organization. They have been for about 30 years now, certainly, as long as I've been in Israel.
Right.
And they're very clear. very clear about what they believe. They believe in the exact same radical Islamic philosophy as ISIS. So, you know, it's important for the world to understand that.
Yeah.
Okay, we're not playing here.
Right.
We're not playing. This is not a nursery. We're talking about a serious, serious political struggle here. And it, from their eyes, it is a religious struggle, and they want to destroy Israel.
All right. Ron is listening in Los Angeles, California. Ron, hi. You are on the air. You know, hang on one quick second here. Let me take a quick pause here for a moment. If you're just joining us, I want to get our guest back. You can join us, 888-914-9149. We are taking a look at the conflict in Israel. As I said, rockets have been fired. 1,500 of those have rained down on Israel from Gaza over the last few days. And lives have been lost, unfortunately. Too many lives have been lost. We are seeing tension, and it's continuing to rise. Israel's Iron Dome system, as I said, shot down some rockets, but many have gotten through. And my guest this afternoon is David Rubin. He's live in Israel tonight. He's witnessed that rocket fire, and he's seen the devastation of what's taking place in Israel. He's the author of a book called Confronting Radicals, What America Can Learn from Israel. And he's back with us again. And David, let's go to the phones. We'll take a call from Ron. Ron's in Los Angeles. Ron, hi, you're on the air with David Rubin. Go ahead.
Thank you. My prayers to all people in that region. Nobody wants to see this kind of violence. But my question is, the guest mentioned that there's no Palestinian flag or national anthem before a certain time, but couldn't the same be said for Israel before 1949? I know that there was violence used in the struggle for a Jewish homeland when it was under the British mandate. And I guess my question is, when any time a people, whoever they are on the globe, gets dispossessed of their land. I mean, it happened in Ireland. It happens various places. There's going to be a pushback of some sort by those who are dispossessed. Isn't there any room for a two-state, two-territory solution? I just looked back at Ireland. I mean, they had horrible violence for decades, and in 1998 they had the Good Friday Agreement, where, you know, sides that looked like they would never, ever come to any sort of an understanding or agreement did so, and there's been relative peace ever since. So I just, as a Catholic, we never like to see this type of violence. It's not an answer, but isn't there room for an agreement of some sort?
All right, great question, Ron. Thank you for the call. David, I only have a few moments for you, but go ahead, I'll let you respond.
Sure, sure. Well, look, first of all, we don't like violence either. You know, anyone who knows Jews knows that we do not like violence. However, if we're talking about flags, yes, certainly the Israeli flag was created in 1948 when the modern state of Israel was created. But if we look at Israel as a sovereign nation, well, you know, you're a Catholic. You know, you know your Bible a little bit. You can go all the way back to King David and King Solomon, and look at hundreds of years, many hundreds of years, that Israel was a sovereign nation, right where I am standing at this very moment. So the Palestinians can't do that. You know, they can't talk about when their so-called country was established. And not every country, not every people that says they want to have a country has a right to a country. And as for a two-state solution, we don't have the space for it here. We're a country the size of New Jersey, and so it's either ours or it's theirs. And, you know, I prefer to side on the right of historical precedent, and we certainly have that here.
All right. Well, David, I want to thank you for being with me. I know it's late there in Israel. I'm grateful for your time. The book, Confronting Radicals, What America Can Learn from Israel. If people want to pick up your book, how do they do that?
Well, best way is to go to the website, which is David Rubin, R-U-B-I-N, DavidRubinIsrael.com, DavidRubinIsrael.com. They could also go to Amazon and just type in the words, Confronting Radicals, What America Can Learn from Israel.
All right, sounds great. Hey, David, thank you. I appreciate you being here tonight. Stay safe, okay?
Thank you, Drew. I appreciate that.
It's David Rubin, again, author of the book, Confronting Radicals, What America Can Learn from Israel. He is live in Israel, and we will continue to monitor what is unfolding over there. Important conversation. I thought the question was good. Should Palestine be declared its own nation? There's so much. It's such a complicated issue, isn't it? About a two-state approach and where this is all going to end. When will the violence quell and what will bring that about? The Biden administration's doing their part right now to try to help. We'll see whether or not they're effective. One thing that you can do is certainly pray, and we certainly need it. Stay with me, though. When I come back, we'll talk more. I want to address one other issue. This directly affects you here in the States. Yesterday in Tennessee, officials there shut down a bridge on Interstate 40 that goes between Arkansas and Memphis, Tennessee. What they found was frightening. And I'll tell you about that when I return. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Everything you've got, the whole bridge over the river fell down. There's cars all over the place.
911.
Yes, I was on the bridge that just collapsed. I'm on like a little island part in the middle. There's a lot of people here too, and I think there could be people trapped in cars is what I'm really worried about.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was real. Can you imagine being one of those people seeing the I-35 bridge in Minnesota collapse in front of your own eyes? Unbelievable. It's a fear a lot of people have when they cross bridges. Yesterday, officials in Tennessee shut down a bridge on an interstate there. They were doing a routine inspection of the bridge, and it showed that a main support beam, they say it cracked. If you see this thing, it was broken, right? You may have heard the word cracked in news reports, but man, the images clearly show that it is not just cracked, it's broken. Anyway, that bridge goes over the Mississippi River at that point, and because of that, the Coast Guard had to close the river to barge and other boating traffic, and that's going to have an impact on farmers up and down the river who rely on those barges for their corn and soybean and wheat, downstream to ships on Gulf of Mexico that are taken around the world. So this is only the latest piece of infrastructure to fail in our country. Just as an example of it, it's been 14 years since that I-35 bridge in Minneapolis, I think they say the I-35W is what they say there, collapsed during evening rush hour. Horrible. Before I want to play for you a conversation coming up in a moment with an expert who has been following this, who's been writing on this, and who will make you aware of what's happening in the country. I've been talking to him for years about our nation's infrastructure. But before I play that conversation, I want you to listen to this NBC News report on some of the conditions of our bridges. Listen to this.
Across the country, bridges crumbling, even collapsing. In Utah, the driver of this car could have been killed when this piece of a bridge smashed through his windshield.
Another 6 or 8 inches, he might not have been talking to me today.
In fact, there are dangerous new cases from Florida to Georgia to Michigan. Americans driving on them 174 million times a day. So many bridges in need of repair, if placed end to end, they'd stretch nearly the distance between New York City and Miami.
It really comes down to a failure of leadership in Congress to address some of these issues and provide additional funding.
Officials have been sounding the alarm for years. In 2016, I visited this bridge in Washington, D.C.
Look at this right up here. This is the roadway,
and there's metal literally peeling right off of it.
Look at this flange right here, paper thin. This is all that's left.
This is what's holding up the roadway.
This beam is holding the bridge up. This is the support for the entire bridge, just completely rusting away. Look at this, Jeff, completely gone.
You can put your hand right through that.
All of this, just rusting from the inside out.
That's frightening, especially if you drive over those bridges every day. It's not just bridges, it's dams, it's tunnels. Our nation's infrastructure need to look at it. There's a bill right now before Congress that's going to pay for infrastructure repairs, but the definition of infrastructure is really expansive, and that makes the bill very expensive. Republicans have proposed a narrow bill dealing with things like roads and bridges, dams and water mains, right? Democrats want something much larger. According to the American Society of Civil Engineers, the U.S. has C-grade on the condition of its infrastructure. You know, and they say, for instance, a water main breaks every 2 minutes in our country. 43% of our roads are in poor or mediocre condition. The last number is the one they say has been stagnant for several years. And they're right about that because I've been talking about this for years. Here's an interview I did a couple of years ago with Barry Lepetner. He is the author of Too Big to Fail. Or no, Too Big to Fall is the name of his book. America's Failing Infrastructure and the Way Forward. He's an attorney who deals with construction and infrastructure. Let me bring you back in time. Listen to this. I'm joined today by Barry Lepetner. He's the founder of a New York City-based law firm called Lepetner Associates. And he wrote a book. We've had him on the program in the past to talk about this, called Too Big to Fail, America's Failing Infrastructure and the Way Forward. And he joins us today just to give us a perspective on the condition of our nation's infrastructure. Hey, it is good to have you back, Barry. Good afternoon.
Drew, always a pleasure to join you.
Yeah, I don't want to scare people. I don't like to do that. But honestly, some of these bridges in major cities do give me pause. Give me your big picture, you know, if you could, of what you're seeing. And then maybe we should also define terms, because you're hearing terms like functionally obsolete and structurally deficient. Maybe we can kind of define what's being said here.
There's two categories here that everyone who's listening just needs to understand, to have a sufficient understanding of the perilous nature of our transportation system. When they say the bridge is structurally deficient, and there's 54,000 of them out of our 600,000 bridges in the nation, what they're saying is the engineers for those bridges have identified significant engineering failures that no longer make that bridge have the structural integrity to support the number of vehicles going over it every day that they were designed for. They have technically failed as engineering structures. So what does the authorities do? What does the federal government tell these states and cities? Close one or more of your lanes so that we don't have that many vehicles going over per hour, and then the bridge is, quote, safe.
Wow.
Okay?
Wow.
Just listen, just understand that they have failed from an engineering standpoint. In other words, if I went into your homes and I told you, look up, there's a leak there, you would say your roof has failed, and you would put a bucket under it, and you wouldn't have to do anything, except over time you're going to need a bathtub, and over time after that you're going to need something else to hold the widening water coming down. That's doing nothing, and that's what we've done. But here is part two. Of those 54,000 structurally deficient bridges, which means they have fracture cracks, they have tremendous corrosion, they have frozen bearings, which means the bridge can't move in cold weather and hot weather the way it's supposed to. One other thing. There are 8,000 bridges throughout our nation, on average 160 in every state, where they are called fracture critical. And that means the way they were designed, if one piece of that complicated structure fails or breaks, the entire bridge goes down, or a section of the bridge goes down.
Wow.
That was the I-35 in Minneapolis, which happened August 1, 2007. It was the Skagit Bridge in Washington, the state of Washington, that went down a few years later, and numerous other bridges that are that vulnerable. So as I go around the country, I sometimes point out, if I speak in a certain city, I said, do you know that bridge that all of you traveled over in the last day or week, and 200,000 vehicles go over it? That bridge could fail at a moment's notice, according to your engineers in your state and reports your state engineers have sent to the federal government. And yet, no one in the community understands how much at risk your children are when they go on those school buses over that bridge. No official is telling everybody that those could collapse and the like. And as I did the research around the country for Too Big to Fall, I asked the bridge engineers themselves, and they said, Barry, we work for state or federal governments. If we were to throw up an alarm and start saying this in mass, we would all lose our jobs, because we're told regularly, do the best you can to keep these bridges going. We have no money. It doesn't look like it's on the horizon. We don't want to panic the public, but let's do whatever we can. That was the message that I got all around the country. And politicians who I spoke to from Congress on said, look, the money is there. We're just not in a position to raise taxes, or we won't get reelected. So it's not going to come up year after year. In whatever form it does come on, it's just not going to be supported widely in our government.
Wow. What are your thoughts on our nation's infrastructure in some of these other areas that have been neglected for a half a century?
Well, let's cover them in very simple, understandable form.
Okay.
We have, according to federal and state officials who are responsible for our dams, 4,000 dams that are in such critical condition, they jeopardize from moment to moment downstream communities and could break, just like we saw the Oroville Dam in California. A hole the size of a football field opened up and water came pouring down. We have 4,000 of those dams in a similar condition. Take water supply. Increasingly, water will become one of the major issues in our country.
Wow.
Supplying water to communities, to growing communities and existing communities, is going to become a critical issue. Every day, 10 billion gallons of drinkable water leak out of our water system because water pipes in most locations are over 100 years old. And this is getting ignored from year to year, the kicking the can down mentality that has happened through our Congress for 4 decades now. This is not a Democratic issue. It is not a Republican issue. It is not an issue that is across any kind of party lines. It's everybody in Congress has turned a blind eye to raising the gas tax, which has not been raised since 1993.
Wow.
It's still 18.4 cents a gallon. And we drive less because our cars are more efficient.
You're right.
And also, we find ourselves slowly moving to electric cars, which certainly don't use gasoline. Everybody must understand that from the foundation of our country, infrastructure has been the primary driver of growth and economic success. We have an Erie Canal built by private interest in 1819 that allowed inland all the way to the Great Lakes for goods to come down the Hudson River and go out to Europe. The grants of land across that way built out our nation in all the way through from New York to the Great Lakes. We gave grants so that private interest could build the Intercontinental Railroad. And those grants built our nation from the end of the Civil War all the way through to the 1900s and after, because the country followed those railroad routes and built out cities along the way. We had the same thing for the TVA, the same thing for the Hoover Dam, and we could go on and on. What people need to understand, whatever the cost for infrastructure, our nation has multiple returns on that investment because it ensures that our military can move security forces around the country easily and safely, that globalism, meaning the goods we make in this country, all the way on the interior of a country and all the way on the exterior, can easily get to ports and airports to be delivered around the world and sold. And finally, it's safety for our citizens and insurances of the supply chain that feeds everybody, clothes everybody.
Here's the problem. We need to get our infrastructure corrected. You know that, right? It's concerning when you hear these types of reports and not a whole lot's being done. There's debate on Capitol Hill as to how this is going to be completed. Republicans look at infrastructure as, you know, your dams, your roads, your waterways, your power grid, things along those lines. Over the past several weeks, very prominent Democrats in Washington, they've claimed that infrastructure means it can range from anything from caregiving to climate action to the Everglades ecosystem in South Florida, and it goes on and on. Police accountability is infrastructure. Court expansion is infrastructure. The new Oxford American Dictionary defines infrastructure as the basic physical and organizational structure and facilities, buildings, roads, power supplies. Let's hope those on Capitol Hill get it right. In fact, let's pray for them now.